And we are live!
Hello!
Finn here and Lydia from Wandering Into Wellness. Welcome back.
Episode 8.
Eight. Yeah, there we go.
Super exciting. And today is even more exciting because we're up on the beautiful little Sugarloaf Mountain. Super sunny and lovely. Mm. And we have an amazing guest with us today. Welcome, Sarah Sproul.
Thanks, Lydia.
Sarah is an occupational therapist with a Master's in Sexuality Studies, and we're here today to talk about all things related to sex.
Sex and families
and kids.
And
families
and growing up with it.
Yeah, all the stuff, the areas of sex really that people usually aren't that comfortable talking about, and even if you hear that idea, sex and kids, people are like, ooh,
immediately stepping.
Absolutely. Oh, I can't do it.
Nobody has a right answer.
No,
they
don't.
It feels like they have a right answer.
Mm. Mm. So it's so nice to have someone here that we can talk to, and those questions. I'm a mum. I have a 3.5-year-old boy, and he's really inquisitive. And in our family, we just have a blanket policy of honesty. And so if he asks those questions, we just tell him the honest truth. And so he kind of knows everything already about sexuality, about sex, how it works, about menstruation, and I guess as a parent you're constantly coming up with, my child knows all this stuff and I'm comfortable with that, but how is this going to work now he's in Montessori?
Yeah.
How are other parents going to feel when he's there talking about vaginas and penises and sperm? What is going to happen?
Namely.
So I guess, you know, that's a question that I'd really be interested in knowing your opinion on.
Mm.
You have kids.
Yeah.
I imagine you were kind of similar to me in that you were honest. And then how did that work out?
Yeah, I've got a story about that. I won't tell you that right now. But what I would say, first of all, is just going back to that. When I said, yeah, sex and families and kids, even when I said that, I went, oh, is that, people are going to take that in different ways. Because I think in our culture, most of the conversations that happen around sex and kids is about sexual abuse,
right?
Child sexual abuse. And so it's not just that we have an absence of talking about healthy sexual development in children, we have the opposite, which is a very large conversation about child sexual abuse, which is important to have because that exists and there needs to be services and awareness about that. But the problem, the difficulty is that it uses up all the resources around sexuality in kids.
Out of the whole argument, or out of the whole debate.
So that's why conversations like this, the more we can have them about how to talk about sexuality in a positive and healthy way with our young kids, can go some way to address that balance. So you're right, it's countercultural, isn't it? Because when the culture says, no, we don't talk about these things with young kids, and you do, there is going to be some
pushback.
There will be, and some conflict. So I tell the story. So my daughter was 8. And we were walking home from school, and we live in Rathmines, so it's a gritty, urban, awesome place. But this particular day, she was walking home with her little friend, and there was a used condom on the footpath as we were walking home from school. Now, I'm a sexuality educator. I wasn't then, but at that point, I was still talking a lot about sex and relationships with our kids, and our contraceptive method of choice at that time was to use condoms. So our kids knew what a condom was, they knew what it was used for.
Yeah.
So my daughter is walking home with her little friend, the same age, and as they go past this used condom on the footpath, she says, oh, yuck. And her friend says, why, what's yuck? And she goes, Alice says, there's a used condom on the ground, that's gross. And her little friend says, what's a condom?
And Alice, forget the used bit. It's a balloon, right?
Yeah. And Alice says, it's something you stop the sperm getting to the egg. That's how we were talking about it at that stage. And her little friend goes, all right. Now that would have been fine, except that the mum of that little girl was walking a little bit ahead and heard that conversation, which I thought was fine. But
she sounds like a great sex educator. Yeah. Yeah. Like, brilliant.
Yeah. And what happened actually the following day was that mum came in to talk to John and myself and just said, look, I didn't want my kid learning that stuff at this point. That's not okay. You're talking to your kids about too much stuff. They shouldn't be talking to other kids about it. So she was calling into question our parenting choices. And fair enough, because they weren't her parenting choices and she didn't have sort of the understanding about why it was important to talk early and often.
Yeah.
And to be fair, we hadn't had this conversation about what do you do when what you choose to parent around sex and relationships with your kids is different, completely different to the outside world.
And it leaks out into other people's parenting choices and affects how their parenting choices are going to go.
Yeah, and I suppose that's for everything. Like, I'm even thinking about food.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are a lot of people that have particular food choices around how they feed their kids.
Absolutely.
And so, and I'm afraid, like, I'll put my hand up, I'm really good at talking about sex and relationships and consent with my kids.
Yeah.
Their vegetable intake is... you know, so you can't can't do everything,
right?
So that's my sweet spot. But again, so when people who are really good with their food bring their kids over to our house and we're less good, it's complex for those parents, you know, and it's this constant sort of butting up again with different philosophies and different ideas, and that's part of living in the world. How do we muck in?
I think it's really hard as well to just, it's part of something that I really struggle with and that I'm trying to work on at the moment, is being able to just say my needs and make my needs be met for me.
Yeah.
I'm good about doing that for my son or for people that I love, but for me, I kind of go, oh no, it's fine, oh I don't need that thing. And once you become a parent, you're kind of, you choose your parenting philosophy, or it appears through trial and error, and then you have to kind of get strong at going like, okay, I'm taking my child to this birthday party, we don't eat a lot of sugar in our household, there's other things that we have allergies with, and I have to be strong about sitting in front of other parents and going, I'm not going to let him eat Haribo, and I'm going to talk to him about why he can't eat it in front of your kids who are eating that Haribo, and I just have to do that, and I have to be okay with that because that's my choice.
Yeah.
And it's that, and then it's the sexual thing, it's everything. You're constantly being met with these things where you have to stand up and go, this is my choice, and I'm okay with my choice, even if it makes you feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that's hard, I think. It's really hard to do that.
And it also, it makes it hard for your kids a little bit as well, because you're making a choice for them that they're not grown up enough to understand why you're making, and so they're kind of saying, well, Mum, why can't I have this thing? Or, Mum, why can't I talk about that in front of... And maybe why can't I even hang out with them? Because I'd imagine that at some level, that probably becomes, well, I don't want blah, 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 hanging out with your children because we don't want them knowing these things.
Yeah, and that actually happened, the follow-on with that conversation was that for a while that friendship cooled. Now, interestingly, a few years later, the younger child in that family was... 7 or 8, I can't remember, and the mum actually came to me and said, I've changed my mind about this. I think it is important to talk early and often, and this is what I'm doing, and we had a really nice conversation about it. So it's sort
That's so gratifying.
What's lovely about it is, even though it's hard in the moment when you come up against that conflict, I think we don't realise what educational potential we have just to live the life we've chosen, particularly if it's not in line with the mainstream.
I think that even for me, when it seemed to start, obviously my son's still really young, but it seemed to start, we decided to use correct anatomical names for things, and my parents would have been brilliant about being really open. They were real hippies, and everyone was kind of naked a lot in our house. There was no questions that couldn't be asked, and it was all very open. But then interestingly, I had my son, and he knew that his penis was a penis, and you know, all the other stuff, and he was talking about that, and they were like, just repelled by the idea that my 2-year-old was walking around talking about his penis.
Your parents were?
Yeah, they were like, you should be saying, it should be a willy or a foo-foo or something. Yeah. And I was like, what? This is his elbow. This is his elbow. That's his penis. You're going to know it's his penis. And I was trying to explain to him in the larger context why that was important as well, that he was able to know if there was something wrong, he could identify. It's kind of less important with boys in those parts, because with girls, if you just have foo-foo, what area is that? Is it inside? Is it outside? What are the areas? And with a boy, it's kind of slightly more linear. But still, I wanted him to be able to tell me, is there pain somewhere? Where is the actual pain happening? Or, you know, in an awful situation, was someone to touch him inappropriately, that he was to know they shouldn't, A, touch him there, and B, where had they touched him? And I was trying to explain to them, that's why it's so important that we know the terms. Because I heard this horrible story in America about they have lots of kind of funny, cute names for areas there, and one of them, in one family, they had called the girl's area a cookie, and the little girl kept saying to her teacher, Daddy keeps eating my cookie, and the teacher was like, oh, I know, but sharing's good, and she kept not realizing what was happening. Just was, okay, Daddy's eating my cookies, it's not really a big deal, and then eventually it came to light that she was being sexually abused by her father, but no one knew, because they were using this cutesy term because it made them all more comfortable. And that's obviously an extreme version, but really that's why this needs to happen. From my point of view, that's why it's so important.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a myth out there that that if we talk about sex and relationships and consent with our kids, that that somehow damages them in some way. But the reality of it is, it's a it provides protection, not just in what you're saying, like if something is happening, they have the language to describe it, but it's also a preventative thing, because kids who use the correct names for their body parts don't come across as victim material. Like they're sort of like, oh, this kid has a bit of cop on now. There's people watching out for them, and they tend to be left alone.
Interesting.
So
that's really, I hadn't thought of it that
security
way.
Thing,
yeah. So while, and I don't know if your audience is mainly Irish, but I think it's important to understand that while we have this idea that it's scary and somehow wrong to talk about sex with young kids and to use the correct names. And by the way, when I say sex, I'm not talking about intercourse and sort of going the whole thing. I'm talking about, people love each other and these are our different parts and our bodies can feel nice. All that sort of thing. It feels dangerous because of our conditioning, but it's not dangerous. Actually, the opposite.
Yeah. So is there, sorry.
Go on. No. So one of the things is like we were chatting about, is there a kid for who that language needs to be slowed down? Is there a kid for who that language needs to be sped up? Like, how much does it need to be tailored, do you think, from child to child, or does it? Or is it kind of like, with all of your children, do you pretty much have the same thing? And do you think that it gives the same result in terms of, you know, their own healthy attitude to sex as they're growing up? Or does it mean that one kid's going to get to doing certain things earlier on than they otherwise would? Or how do you think that works?
So you're talking about if we talk about it, will they do it more often?
Yeah, I think that's probably what most the fear a lot is.
And
about,
again, the research shows the exact opposite. The more that parents and kids can talk about this, as it becomes sort of a culture in their family that we talk about this and we teach each other and we learn different things, that those kids are less likely to engage in, well, we used intercourse as an example, they're less likely to do that sooner. So they're more likely to delay that, and they're more likely to use safer sex practices.
So it's
preventative and protective on so many levels, these conversations. And I would just say that the language, Finn, you asked an interesting question about kids' ages and different kids having different abilities to engage in this. From when a child is born, a parent can start practicing using correct anatomical names. So when a nappy is changing, I'm just wiping your vulva, or I'm cleaning your penis, or whatever it is. And while the kid may not understand what's going on, for the parent, that is the perfect opportunity to start practicing using
to
those words for ourselves.
Yeah,
so it's almost not so much the kid as the parent. Now, I would say there are children with particular learning needs or with physical disability, and so it's slightly different, but at the same time, as long as the premise is that sex is not dangerous in itself, what is dangerous is ignorance and an inability to communicate and talk about it, which provides a protective focus. So I've talked to mums who have children that are non-verbal, and they would be, you know, 10, 11 and 12, and the children don't speak. So there is complexity, but there is still opportunity to talk about bodies and create a culture of openness and care.
And lack of shame.
Yes.
And that's such a big one here in Ireland, isn't it, really? There's been such a massive culture of shame around sexuality. And I was brought up in England and then in Asia and various different places. And then I moved here when I was about 21, and it was, I obviously came from a background that was more open, but it really amazed me when I came here first that people...
Pretty much night and day.
Yeah, it was very different. I was so open about talking about that stuff, and there wasn't shame. There was never shame in my family around anything to do with sexuality I just felt empowered about it, and it was this thing that could be enjoyed, and, you know, and I knew all the repercussions, and I knew all the ins and outs of it, and I felt empowered about talking about it.
It's funny, though, as your mum's grown older, she's become more conservative with her.
Right.
Isn't that interesting? We supposedly do get more conservative as we age.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
But I think it's also very hard to live in a culture, because I've discovered this for myself. So I moved here when I was 29, and I've been here 17 years, and so I, you know, growing up in Australia, I had some time in Nigeria as well for 7 years. So there was sort of like, I've got this multicultural thing going on.
Yeah.
And I was open. I've become a sex educator. I wasn't then. But there was still, I remember this moment in time where I was with a partner, a fairly new partner. I'd only been with him about a month. And I had in my suitcase some fishnet stockings, you know, because that was something I liked. Yeah. I enjoyed wearing fishnets, talking to them. Yeah. And we were there, and I said, look what I bought. Yeah. And he sort of went, ah, we don't need those. And the shame, wow. It was so bizarre. Like, and I was robust, but in those moments where we're very vulnerable
because we're
showing who we are, yeah. It's very easy to get knocked back. And that story is a long time ago, but it's crystal clear in my mind.
That's
and
amazing.
I often think back to it going, damn it, in that moment, if I could have just said, well, I actually do want it, you know?
Yeah.
So I suppose what that illustrates...
It's not just an Irish problem, that lack of assertiveness.
No. And particularly not in terms of asserting for our own sexual interests and our own sexual needs. That is a lifelong journey.
Absolutely,
because our bodies are going to be changing all the time. Our interests change, we get sick, we get injured, and so what we need sexually for ourselves is going to be different.
Mm.
And how is it possible to accept that, first of all, that things are changing, and even from one day to the next? And then the next sort of trick is then how are we able to communicate that? And, and I think it's okay that it's actually a little bit complex, because that's the human existence, that we learn as we go along.
Yeah.
And I would say that too in parenting, that this conversation, for maybe there are people out there watching this and they have not ever used a correct anatomical body name. And that's absolutely okay. That is not your fault. There is no shame in that. Mm. That is just
where you are.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
And so then the question becomes, okay, so now you have more information. Could it be possible to do something different? And if it is possible, what is the smallest, easiest possible step that you can take to change things?
Yeah, and I think that's so important, because it's something that I'm often talking about in my classes, is micro actions for macro change. And I just think it's exactly that. Often when we want to make change in our life, we think about that end point, and it seems so overwhelming that you just go, okay, I can't do this. I'm not going to do it because it's too much. Whereas if you just set like achievable little tiny steps, like I'm just going to use one term that's anatomically correct, and I'm going to practice that for a while.
Yeah.
We can all do that.
Yeah.
And then when it sits more comfortably with us, then we can go on to those
and
larger,
more
complicated.
And it creates a cascade. Always does, doesn't it? Because your mind just, it kind of unlocks a little door where you're like, okay, well, kind of this is okay. And then suddenly things, it's the same way with everything, with food, with exercise. Mm. It's the little baby steps that are really important.
I have a question that I really don't want to forget, because I've been thinking about it for a while. I have a son, I don't have a daughter, who knows if that's even going to ever happen. I don't know if that's another conversation, but... I have so many of my friends who have daughters say, well, what, we've got vagina, we've got vulva, we've got clitoris, we've got labia.
Yeah.
Is there a word that covers the whole area?
Vulva covers the whole external area.
Okay.
So oftentimes people, if they're comfortable, will say, that's your vulva, and inside you have a vagina.
Okay.
It was interesting, a few years ago I sort of read something that was saying, look, when we use the word vagina, what we're sort of talking about is a very functional piece of anatomy, and there's no, well, 70% of women don't orgasm vaginally, you know, so when we just concentrate on the vagina as the name, it sort of limits young girls' ability to comprehend that sex is pleasurable.
Yeah.
Now,
and for guys to relate with what they should maybe be looking at.
Yeah, it kind of goes straight to the end.
Yeah.
So, which is a consistent issue.
Yeah, exactly. So I think using the word vulva is a great, it's better, but even to point out that girls have a vulva and a clitoris, and to start using the word clitoris very early. My sister has a gorgeous, almost 3-year-old, and she is already using the word clitoris, and she do it in that little toddler speak. It's so cute, and she doesn't say it quite right, but it's really cute. Now, one thing I would say actually is, and my own life is an example of this, that when we start using words or have conversations about how babies are made, that just one conversation is not going to be enough.
Yeah.
Mm.
So when I was 6, my mum was pregnant with my second brother, and she remembers me asking, so how did the baby get in there? And my mum's a nurse, and she's pretty straightforward, and she said all the things and answered all the questions. Oh, right, okay, we understood, that was good, that was good, that was good. So that was when I was 6, and Tim was born, and that was perfect. 3 years later, I remember talking to my friend, I was 9, and I had forgotten how babies were made, because it wasn't an ongoing conversation. Yeah. So I was there with my friend. We were under this big avocado tree in a town in Nigeria, right. And the avocados were prolific. And we're looking up at the sky and talking about different things, and my friend says, so, do you know how babies are made? And I go, yeah, I think so. And she describes what it is, and I go, oh, I didn't think it was that. I thought the seeds flew through the air, right? Flew through the air. I'd sort of made this
wild
idea
up. Sexual education.
Yeah. And my friend laughed, and she said, what, like avocado seeds? And it was just this funny moment where we're imagining big avocado seeds. But the point is that one conversation is not enough.
Yeah.
And these need to be ongoing things. So, and it's really, unfortunately, it's a parent's responsibility, because kids are not going to necessarily ask questions all the time, because either the time isn't right, or they don't feel like the environment is conducive to asking questions, or someone has already told them something that is inaccurate, and so they don't feel like there is a question that needs asking. Yeah. So, do
you say, like, okay, switch off Peppa Pig for a moment, and we're just going to have a chat about this? I'm not a parent, as you can tell.
My preference actually is to not make it the thing.
Yeah, so it's not the chat. Yeah.
Yeah. So, for example, if you can think of something that you do every day with your kids, and you link that to a conversation you want to have. So, for example, it could be cleaning teeth. Could be getting in the car, driving to the shop. It could be putting on their boots and coat ready to go for a walk. But if you link in your mind some specific thing that always happens, and then you promise yourself that every second day you're going to say, oh, by the way, did you remember that conversation we had yesterday about penises? Well, I learned something new. Did you know?
Got you.
And it's just...
And it normalizes it by just bringing it into everyday activities, rather than like, and now we are sitting down to have a big shameful talk that everyone dreads, and around the table. And
Oh,
it just has to be like part of life, right? That it's not this thing that's separate from life, that there is sex, and then there is us.
Other
and
bits,
then,
yeah, exactly,
it's like
the rest.
It is all.
Yeah.
And what I love too is this idea that the adult is not the know-all person. It's really important to demonstrate that you're learning as you go.
Okay,
like you know stuff, but demonstrating that we're all... So to start off a conversation with, do you know what I learned yesterday? Yeah. Or someone told me yesterday, or I was thinking about you yesterday, and it occurred to me that we hadn't had the conversation. Now, the words I'm using are sort of for older kids, but you can think of a way to translate into for a kid who's three.
I mean, my kid's kind of... He's unusual, I think. So he knew he had kind of asked me. He's always coming to the toilet, and I would have my period, and he would see the blood, and he would ask me, what is that? And so now he knows he asked me, and he's got a fairly good handle on menstruation and why it happens and all of that. And he'll be like, do you need your pad, Mom, or do you need your this? And, you know, so he knows that. And then that kind of led on to actually, like, how is babies made, and asking those questions. And he kind of knew basic functionality of it, but he hadn't obviously thought through the detail of, how does the sperm actually get inside? It was just sperm goes to meet the egg. But and then we were lying in bed the other day, and he was like, Mum, there's a hard bit in my testicle. And I thought, well, I'm pretty sure he just means, like, that's his testicle, but maybe there is a lump, like, I have to know. So he's like, feel it. I'm like, okay. So I felt it. I was like, no, that's just your testicle, but why is it hard, and what's in there? And I was like, well, that's where the sperms are kept. And he was like, and I could just see this look on his face, and he was like, the sperms are kept in the testicles, and he was like, and the sperm has to get to the egg. And then he was like, oh, how did the sperms get to the egg? And I was, okay, we're having this conversation at 5 o'clock in the morning. So the sperms come from the testicles, out through the penis, and then they go to the egg. The penis? So, but where does the penis go? Yeah, the penis, daddy puts the penis into mommy's vagina, and then the sperm comes out and it goes to meet the egg. The penis goes into the vagina.
Revolution!
And I guess his little mind was just like tick, 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 tick. And then he was like, okay, the penis goes into the vagina. The sperm swims up to meet the egg. It meets the egg. A tiny baby starts growing in the belly. The belly gets bigger and bigger. And then eventually, pop, out comes the baby. it's born. But so like 3.5, you know, that's fairly.
And the thing is that they'll probably start the conversation for you.
I have that child that's.
Are there kids that you really have to encourage a lot more than that? Is there?
Yeah.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah, because out of my three kids, I've got one kid that asks questions about everything, everything. And then the younger one, because I'm talking so much at this level, sometimes I forget that, oh, he hasn't really asked a question about that, and I need to actively start things, which is fine. Some parents may find, I suppose this is the thing about our parenting, that some people have the skill to start conversation, and some parents have the skill to answer questions, right? So we need to find, what is our sweet spot as a parent? Particularly, I will acknowledge that if the groundwork hasn't been laid when they're 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 even, when they don't have the yuck factor, young kids don't have the yuck factor, so you can really have wonderful conversations. Okay. So you're getting older than that, they start to get a bit, and they start to maybe shut down the conversation. So if you've got a kid that's at that older age, like 10, 11, 12, it's going to be more difficult, but that's where this whole idea about coming back to the community, that we don't parent alone, like that we all have complementary skills and we can help each other in this way.
I guess something that I'm interested in knowing about is, so I feel really comfortable answering those questions to my son right now, but I was thinking about what happens if they find out through someone else about a topic that might be too old for them or that you feel is uncomfortable. So say, for example, rape, and they come to you at 3.5 and say, what is rape? How do you talk about that in a way that isn't scary for them? Because I feel like there's a lot of information out there about consent and how we used to teach our kids about consent at the moment, and that's really important. And in schools, for example, they're not allowed to hug each other, that you have to ask permission, and they're not really meant to hug each other anymore, which I kind of feel is sad, but anyway, that's the
really?
Way it is. Yeah, like my son was being told off all the time when he was first at school for hugging other children. And I was like, but hugging is lovely. I know. It is
sad. They do have a point, though, because if your son is a huggy, touchy-feely person, there are some of us who
don't like that.
Don't like it.
Right.
Yeah.
So he needs to say, he's not allowed in school, but in general it should be, is it okay if I hug you?
Okay.
And
if
you say no, no means no, and that's it, right? But I guess what you don't want to be doing is, you know, I remember we had this thing when we were younger of stranger danger, and, you know, if someone talks to you on the side of the road, you know, you don't talk to them.
Don't take sweets from them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then it's quite hard, though, when they're really little, because you don't want to put this idea into their head that all people they meet are scary, and that there is this threat, or the idea of rape, and how would you even explain that to a three-year-old? Is it the case that you just say, that's a really good question, and let's talk about that when you're older? Or is there an answer? How would you?
Yeah, three. I have not heard of a three-year-old actually asking that question. But if a three-year-old asked that question of me, I would say, sometimes people do things to other people that they don't like.
Okay.
Now, that you could just keep it as broad as that. If you haven't had any of these foundational conversations, it's very
don't
difficult.
Don't start there. Yeah.
Yeah. Or you could, and you could go on, you could say, sometimes people do things to other people they don't like, and sometimes they do it to their genitals or parts of their body which are generally private, and you ask permission usually. I think it's important to acknowledge how rape makes us feel, because there's a certain emotional intelligence in that. So I remember, again, 8, I think my daughter was, and we were in the car and the radio came on and they were talking about something in the news, some rape case, and she said to me, what is rape? And I remember feeling really uncomfortable and wanting to protect her so much, right? And what he said, I wish the world wasn't like this. So that's what I started. That's what I started with. I said, you know what? I wish the world was a perfect place where everyone could be happy and feel love. But the world isn't like this, and I wish you didn't have to hear about this, but it's important you do.
Okay.
So you preface it. You acknowledge that you're feeling uncomfortable because, you know, it's not, we don't like to talk about it because it's upsetting, and it's about broken people, two broken people, really. Yeah. Someone who is willing to invade someone else and the person who's being invaded. And then you can say, like, you can preface it by also saying, sex is something that happens, or intimacy is something that happens, when two people want it. So you frame it in consent. And when someone doesn't want it, and then someone does something. You know, I'm really careful not to sort of say, I don't talk about it in a gendered way. Like, I don't say you wouldn't do that. I wouldn't anyway, because rape can be quite a diverse experience. Mm. And I also wouldn't talk about it in terms of a penis in a vagina, because rape can happen in other parts of the body. So I generally keep it more general. Now, interestingly, a few years ago, my son came to me one day because he'd heard at school, one of his friends had said, oh yeah, I know what rape is. Rape is when you have sex with someone and then you kill them. Now, just trigger warning, everyone, I'm really sorry, but it's important to have these conversations, right? This is why we're here. And he came to me because we'd had these conversations. So he said, that's not right, is it? And I went, no, it's not right. Rape is when you do something to someone else sexually and they don't want it. But what is interesting about that story is, if we're not clear about what rape is, children fabricate
a more scary
thing. But not only that, they can't identify what rape is. So if that child grew up thinking rape was at the end someone dying, then they don't have the ability and the nuance to understand really subtle things about consent. Now, they were still young. Again, it's 8 or 9, I think they were then. But it's just an illustration of how important it is to be clear and to be approachable, and to, when these misunderstandings come up, just sort of, you need to constantly be correcting. So it comes back to that constant flow of information, like we do about everything else, like diet and exercise and our emotions and sexuality, is just part of that ebb and flow of information that comes to and from a parent and their kid. And that is a two-way thing, because here I am telling a story. My kid taught me something that day when he told me that story. You know, he taught me about how children create solutions or definitions, and he taught me that kids talk to each other. Yeah. He taught me that he was confident in the relationship we had, that he could come. So
that's cool.
And that's what you really want. I mean, as a parent, for me, such an important thing for me is to feel that my child can come to me and ask me any question, and that there's not going to be he's not going to be shamed, he's not going to be shut down, he's not going to be made to feel like that question's an inappropriate question.
Yeah.
That there's that open dialogue between us, and that he's never going to get in trouble if he just tells me what he's thinking right there and tells me the truth.
Yeah. So it sounds so simple, doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In reality, is so much harder than that.
And in fact, and for people whose children are older, the work is harder in that case. Start early. Mm. And it's okay if you didn't start early. There's always time. Whenever you start is a good time, because if you start today and in 2 years' time, you're going to look back and go, thank God I started that day and I didn't leave it till now, because I've got 2 years of quality attempts at creating an environment where we can talk about sex. So it's one thing I would say is, it's gone out of my head.
I was going to ask, actually, particular resources. I'd love to be able to give people like some things that they can kind of attach to, books or people who are online or particular ways that, like, for parents who have maybe tiny kids, like toddlers or infants, and maybe where it's been more difficult in that situation, like, what is there a good resource people can go to try and give their 11, 12-year-old, whatever, some sort of grounding, some sort of solid grounding, so that they know when they're going out into the world they'll be in a safer place.
So you're asking for accurate information, because there's a lot of information out there, and particularly if your kids are online now and they have access to so much good information and so much really shockingly bad information. There is a set of books by Robie Harris. If you Google Robie's, R-O-B-I-E Harris, there's three books for different age groups. They're sort of cartoony type things, and the information is really, really solid. One thing I would say is that no resource is going to be absolutely perfect. And just like we accept imperfection in ourselves, we need to accept that there aren't perfect resources out there. So when you get a book and you are reading it with your kid, or you're giving your kid to read, we need to start fostering sort of critical media consumption. So if you see something that you don't quite agree with, you're not sure, you might just point out to your kid, they're using that word. I don't think that word is the best word, you know, and you could use a different word. Or if a book is heteronormative, so it's always showing families with a mum and a dad, you know, you could say, you know, there are other families, don't you? And you can talk about that. So those three books are really good. Younger than that, the HSC put out a resource just this week, actually, called Tom's Power Flower. It's a really thin little book, and it's a simple way to talk about how babies are made. That is really basic, and it's Irish, so that's nice. Again, it's a mum and a dad.
Okay. And I was going to ask how Irish is it, like, in an unfortunate way.
Yeah, but you know, you have to start somewhere, and I would absolutely be about where those of us who live in Ireland, we approach the world in a particular way for a reason. You know, that's we're not the Netherlands and we're not Denmark, and so how is it possible to accept where we've come from and the resources we have and layer a conversation on top of that, which is about acceptance but also moving forward?
Yeah. That's one of the biggest problems, I think, from a race point of view, in so many things, is that forgiveness and acceptance of a cultural norm, not a cultural norm, but where it's come from, and just kind of like, okay, this is part of us, how can we move on from here? As opposed to kind of like, do you want to be like those guys, or these guys over there? You know,
It's just acceptance, isn't it?
Yeah,
for
sure.
So, gender stereotyping is something that I wanted to talk about, because I guess I grew up in this open way, and it just sort of wasn't really a part of my childhood. My parents had friends of all different types, and I was exposed to lots of different types of relationships, and just wasn't something that I identified as separate. And then I had my son, and just really soon people started saying, he's a real boy's boy, isn't he? And, oh yeah, he's a real man, and you're not going to have to worry about him growing up to be gay. And I was like, what is this? Like, how is this happening?
He's like,
when he was like one and a half, it was really like, and the people saying to me, when you grow up, you're going to get married to a girl, and then you're going to have these babies. And I was like, oh, I don't know whether I like, this is making me uncomfortable. Why do we have to, like, tell him what he's going to, why can't we just let him know that these are the options and then talk about them all in this really open way? But I think there's still this idea that, from some people, that if you start feeding them with ideas, they're going to somehow become gay. And that's going to be this terrible outcome that's going to happen. And it sounds like that's an insane thing to say, but it is there, and it's really present. I mean, it's really present. Or don't say that in front of him, because why are you telling him
but
about
two men? But even despite all that and that suppression, there's still something. It's like 60% of kids under 14 in the UK don't identify as gay or straight.
Really?
They're under 16, or of the age of 14, something like that. There's an amazing statistic I just read like a couple of months ago. So it's like that gender fluidity is happening.
It's happening.
Irrespective of what repression is being.
But I guess as a parent, what do you do in those situations? Like if someone says that to your child, in front of your child, or to you, I find it hard to make a balance between not making it an issue by this is a big deal, also just naturally making it more fluid like that.
Well, that comes down to personal comfort level, doesn't it? Because I'm at the point now where in my parenting I would say something. So we were in a coffee shop a few months ago, and the barista commented on my appearance and says something like, oh, women like to dress up nicely, or something like that. And my son was there, and I said to the barista, I laughed and I said, yeah, and in our family the men like to dress up really nicely too, we all care about our appearance. And the barista said, oh yeah, of course, you're right. And it was very light, but there would have been years ago where I wouldn't have had the understanding of what was going on, first of all, and then I wouldn't have the ability to be sort of assertive and push back just a little bit to redress that in the hearing of my son. So I've had experiences too where we were walking along the street, and this wasn't in Ireland now, actually, this is in Melbourne, my hometown, and the big football crowd was coming out of the stadium, and lots of people very happy that their team had won, and there was a woman walking in front of me and my two boys, high heels and shorts. It looked really obviously on a night out, and there were three lads that sort of walked past her and wolf whistled and whatever, and just sort of were foul, but in a sort of a way that the culture goes, well, that's the way it is, you know. And because my boys were there, I thought, you know what, I can't let this go. So as I walked past those guys, I just went, not cool, guys, not cool, and kept walking. Now, I don't know if that made any difference to them, but for me it was important that that I'm demonstrating this, calling out culture. Now, we would be really clear in our family, if you don't feel safe, you don't do anything like like, it's really important to stay safe, but isn't it great to try and make the world a better place? So back to the question, I think humor is a good way to deal with it. So in that instance, I would say, oh, or he might grow up to marry a man or whatever, and just have a little laugh, depending on But again, you have to prioritize.
Challenge it with humor, yeah.
Yeah, prioritize the relationship you have with the person and the relationship with your son. You're just, you're sort of in the moment, and not to beat yourself up when that happens in the moment. You don't go home, well, ideally you don't go home and say, damn it, I could have done that so much better. It's like, okay, softly, softly. What if that happened again, what would I like to happen? Yeah. And this is where good friendship comes in, because you get to role play then. Yeah, go, Finn, this happened. Can I just practice on you? Will you just say this thing, and I'm gonna I'm gonna have a go at saying something different to what I said.
Yeah. It's the best way to do it, isn't it? Because often, like, we're caught in those moments. There's just too many moving parts to really.
Yeah.
We're not that good as human beings to be able to constantly be on a level to go, like, actually, I know how to address it. Humor and good grace.
It's not possible.
It also depends what your personal history is with conflict.
Mm. Yeah.
And like, how do you meet conflict in a moment? Some people, they go towards conflict. Some people, they show. Like, my natural thing in a conflict situation is to just go, and I'm really working on that, really trying to go, okay, actually, and even tiny things of picking my son up from school and being told, you know, oh, he hit this kid today, or he did this, and me just, oh, right, I'm really sorry, and then going home and go, why did I not advocate for him, why did I not use that as an opportunity to go, well, can you tell me a bit more about that, or I'm actually comfortable with you talking in front of him about that, could we talk about this another time, and that's been a real learning process for me, because I know it's an issue for me to deal with conflict, and in the moment, retrospectively, I'm able to really, really be great. I'm able to, like, and they come up with the best answers.
Yeah,
unfortunately, that's not
good.
So, it's nice to kind of have that thing, that awareness of not beating yourself up in that moment and going, okay, this actually just gives me a chance that the next time I can do a little bit better and then move on from that.
And I think that what you're describing so beautifully, this idea of how the learning as a parent that we gain through our kids and their interactions with the world, like, there's so much rich chance to develop ourselves and the things that we perceive as weaknesses, and we can develop them into strengths. Yeah, it's just a beautiful story, actually.
Another one that's really important for me, and this is a real kind of buzz topic for me and has been for a good few years, is pornography and the effect of pornography on the rising sexuality of, well, the rising emerging sexuality of teenagers today. And when we were growing up, we're the same age, we're both 36 this year, I think. Porn was there, but it was there in like the hidden magazine under the mattress, or, you know, the stolen look at your dad something or your mom something.
Yeah.
It wasn't just like free reign on the internet to just see whatever. And it's not, even when it first came on the internet, it was in much more sort of, let's say, vanilla formats. And now it's like there's a whole range or gamut of stuff that's right there.
Yeah.
And what I'm hearing a lot from people who have teenagers, or from when I've done little forays into talking to teenagers in schools about healthy body awareness and what's happening, is that I remember my first sexual experiences, the feeling that I came away with was, did I like that? Did I enjoy that? Do I want to do that again? And now what they seem to be coming away with was, do I look okay? Did it look okay? Maybe did it taste okay? Did they think I performed okay? And it's taking it away from, do I actually like this? Like, does this feel nice for me? Which is kind of what, for me, that sexual time is about, is like, do I enjoy this? Do I want to do this again? Would I like it to be done harder or softer? All those things that you're learning, that's the learning process. Instead, it's about, does the other person think I look, taste, feel, sound okay? And that's coming from the fact that all these guys are learning, their learning resource now is porn, and everyone's bleached, and they have bodies that don't look like normal bodies, and they aren't often orgasming realistically, that's fake orgasm, and the whole thing is setting this framework that's hugely unrealistic. And it's not that it's the boy's fault, but they're coming to their first sexual experiences with this completely unrealistic set of expectations of how the girl's going to look and how they're going to behave. And when they don't, they're, you're weird, yours has got hair, and yours is like, why is it that color, and why didn't you make this noise? And then for the girls, there's, okay, we have to be that, and we have to look at that. And that, for me, is just absolutely terrifying.
Understandably. And, like, it's happening so young that I think, by the age of 7 or 8, they're likely to have been there, have seen some of the, you know, the more depraved stuff that's around, which they're so not ready for, whatever. But talking about rape in a conversation, I mean, it's kind of on the same kind of spectrum, isn't it, in terms of stuff they're not ready for, stuff that maybe is, like, the worst side of sex.
Yeah. So it comes down to, again, creating a culture of being critical with our media consumption.
Okay.
And you could consider, to make it easy to talk about, that porn is just another sort of form of media.
Mm.
Right. So in our house, we talk about porn as entertainment, and it's for adults, and it's not real, and you sort of can compare it to the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Okay.
You know, that when you watch Thor, you know, saving the day, that you don't go out and expect yourself to be Thor and your partner in crime to be Black Widow or
that's
whatever,
really,
you know.
That is really good, yeah, and that's so relatable.
It's absolutely, it puts it right in the
we
world.
We all know that we don't have the muscles of Thor.
Yeah.
We know, like, we're not just going to suddenly get Thor's muscles, and when we take that hammer, it's not going to be like, it's going to be like, oh, that was actually quite sore.
But again, you know, it's hard for parents of our generation to talk about these things because we haven't, porn is, so it was so behind closed doors, and so
there's, we didn't grow up in the same way.
No, and you know, if I say to the parents, yeah, you should all be talking about porn, I could almost also be saying, and you should be Thor and go out and save the universe. It is so impossible to do it, right? So another way to think about this would be to consider talking about sexuality in terms of pleasure, because when you talk about like you did, when you're with someone, it should feel nice. And this was actually one of the main findings coming out of a friend of mine. She did her master's looking at the sex ed curriculum, the Irish sex ed curriculum, Anna Keogh. She's a great sex educator. But that's a shout out, Anna. Basically, her premise is that if we teach kids that consent feels good, right, then all of a sudden you start changing the way you look at exploring, because at the end of the day, exploring is exploring. We all had to learn somehow. But if you start your exploring with the understanding that this is meant to feel nice, so I'm exploring what feels nice for me and how can I take care of the other person, like make sure that they're okay, sort of that. So consent is absolutely the bedrock of any conversation to do with porn and adolescent exploration, because I think sometimes as parents we feel uncomfortable with sexual development, the developing sexuality of a young person, but that is how it happens.
It is happening.
You know? Yeah, and they might start off kissing down the lane or having a little feel or whatever, and it's just, as parents, if we can come to terms with that is how sexuality develops, and how as parents can we provide information or a culture at home that normalizes exploring, but expect a certain critical, questioning.
Checking and self-checking with it. It makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And it not drawing a distance between you and your kid as a result of this sex thing in the middle, because that's the worst possible result, isn't it?
Now, even just, it was like people just couldn't talk about the word porn. You know, so everyone knew. Everyone was watching porn in their bedrooms. Parents knew, the kids knew, the kids knew, the parents knew, but no one talked about the fact that everyone knew that it was happening.
Yeah.
So then it just became this kind of seedy, gross thing that no one talked about, and it was behind the closed doors, and, oh, they're going to come in, shut the door, you know. And I think it would be so much better if there's that, like you're saying, that if we're comfortable as parents to go, here are the parallels. And I hadn't thought of it that way of talking, because my son's always asking me these days, like, is Spider-Man real? Is Peppa Pig real? Are they alive, is the way he keeps saying. Are they alive? And I'm saying, no, they're alive in the story. And it's just a story that someone's created, and that's really fun to us, enjoy that story. And that's it, isn't it? It's the same thing. It's saying, you know, really, porn is just a story that we're telling that's enjoyable and that's fun, but we have to really understand it is not real.
Yeah, it's not real. Yeah. And you can also break down the particular issues. So you mentioned there about porn shows a particular body type for both genders if it's heteronormative porn, right? So I sort of, you can have that conversation about body type in mainstream media. So for advertising, you can be pointing out, see that billboard, look at that, that's the same skinny woman with large breasts, and look at that guy, look at his pecs and his big shoulders, the same sort of thing. Do you think everyone's body is like that? No, mom, body's not like that. And so you're just constantly reinforcing this thing of what we see doesn't show reality,
I think there's just one last topic that I'd really like to touch on, which is something that I think for me is really important, and that people really feel uncomfortable with, is the idea of sort of, well, the typical word would be masturbation. I kind of prefer the idea of self-love really as a term for that. But it's something that happens. It's something that's part of, when we're talking about exploring, we need to have that relationship with ourselves. We need to have that love with ourselves. We have to figure out what feels good. And one of the ways that we figure out what feels good for us in sexuality is to explore ourselves and to play with ourselves. And I think as parents, when we get to those teenage years, a lot of that time is just like, oh God, they're going to be masturbating. What do we do? Don't talk about it. And then everyone just feels like gross about it. Mm. And what are the ways that we can bring the conversation, the topic of masturbation, the topic of self-love, into a parental sphere that makes everyone know this is happening, it's totally fine, but here are the boundaries, here are the parameters within which it's okay for us to function as a family, and this is happening, and we all know it's happening, but we can do it in a respectful way.
Yeah. One way to do it is to link masturbation to something else. So, for example, you could talk about it in terms of helping someone get to sleep. So oftentimes, masturbation is something that's very relaxing. Mm. So I've had families who will, and this is when kids are still very young, you're trying to avoid the yuck factor again. Yeah. So maybe 7 or 8 or even 6. With boys, there's time, you know, when they start waking up and they have erections. Yes. That's a really great time to start talking about, you know what, penises feel good.
Yeah.
And oftentimes people learn about what feels nice on their body by touching their penis or doing whatever, and that can be useful to go to sleep. Some people, if they touch their penis, it helps them go to sleep. And you can do the same thing with girls. I mean, obviously it's easier because the penis is right there and it promotes conversation. But so I would link it to something else. But again, I'm so conscious, Lydia, that you have the capability to have these conversations, and that the conversation we're having is really, this is high level stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm really, I want to be clear that not every parent can do this again, right?
Yeah,
so
okay.
That's okay. But how could it be possible to find someone who can have these conversations? So I don't know if every family has that cool auntie or uncle or person that can come in and talk about everything.
Yeah.
And I've heard stories where parents have been having a conversation with a friend and they've decided to do this on purpose. The friend comes over and they start talking about masturbation at the kitchen table when the kids are around doing the dishes or whatever. And the kids don't come in and participate, but are they listening or whatever?
Yeah,
you know, as soon as you use the word penis or vulva or clitoris or vibrator or whatever, all of a sudden the kids is picked up. I've had a personal experience where I've been having a conversation with my younger kid and the older kid was like, I don't want to hear this. And they walked out of the room. But they stayed up,
that's
so I could hear them. They're listening, you know. And so that is a really useful way to you talk to the kid who doesn't have the yuck factor,
yeah.
And the older kid will be listening and getting the information. But for younger children, it's that broader concept of our bodies can feel nice.
Yeah.
Hugs feel nice. Being in the bath might feel nice. Now, obviously, each body has a different what feels nice,
yeah,
you know. Mm. So we acknowledge that just because that feels nice for me when I rub my arm and I stand under the shower like this doesn't mean it feels nice for you. Mm-hmm. You need to investigate that for yourself. What
do you think
nice
we need
body?
To put boundaries on the areas in which it can happen, or like it's okay if this happens?
Yeah,
well, like, is it okay? That's something that you can do in the bathroom or in your bedroom, or is that something that is making it all?
Is it all
kind of
altogether
awkward?
Like kind of putting it behind closed doors?
Yeah,
again,
exactly.
What are we doing with it? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, each family is going to have a different what's okay. So your family had a particular what's okay. My family did, Finn's, and that's all going to be different. So, but as the child gets older, it is important to say privacy is best, because you go back to consent. Do I want to see you masturbating in the lounge room? I don't really. And so how are we going to look after you, and how are we going to look after me?
Yeah, okay. Could you introduce the fact that maybe as an adult you have a nick factor too?
Yeah, absolutely. We all have a nick. And actually that's something really interesting when we're talking about consent, that we are mirroring caring for ourselves, because we're showing a young person what it looks like for someone to care for themselves in a way that they will ask for what they need, like you were saying before, or they will say, this is not okay for me, we need to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Cool.
So, yeah.
I get it. That's cool. Debbie, we'll better wrap it up.
We have.
This is fascinating.
So
really fascinating.
What I wanted to say was, if people listening are really interested in talking about this more, if they have questions, if they feel like they're looking for resources, if they want someone to help them or guide them through this journey, how can they get in touch with you? What are the best ways to get that to happen?
So I have a website, thetalk.ie. It's my Irish website. And at the moment, when you go there, you will see that it's a membership site, but it's currently closed because we're designing all the great things.
Okay.
What I'm doing for the future is to create a community for parents to be able to talk, to have conversations like this. See, there's three of us. Yeah. Not everyone has the luxury of being able to do this. Yeah. So I'm creating an online community to allow us all to have a safe space as parents where we can learn more stuff and talk to other parents and find out what everyone else is doing and the complexities and the difficulties and the wins, right? So that's the talk.ie. You can leave your email address there. If you have a specific question, you can email, Google Sarah Sproul or the talk.ie and get an email to me some way, and I'm happy to answer specific questions. But that membership will hopefully be rolling out in the second half of this year. I'm really excited about it because see, as we keep talking about things, we keep having to acknowledge everybody's situation is different, and everyone's starting point is different.
It's
and
not a blanket
we
thing.
All need resources to do this thing. Yeah.
And really, for us, this podcast is like, let's set a starting point. Let's get people talking. Let's show that these are issues that we can talk about, and then. Okay, we can talk about this, and then other people can just start to maybe ruminate on it. No matter where they are in their journey, they can have the opportunity to.
And the nice thing with the podcast, it kind of hopefully people have a chance to kind of do it on their own. Maybe their partner, they're not that away, or they go, "Oh, I listened to this podcast.
Have
a go yourself."
It's
a nice hope.
And for
way.
Us, what's so nice is that because we're interviewing people that are in Ireland, it's not like, "Oh, you've heard this, and wow, this is this great guest. She's in America." It's like, you're here. Yeah. You're a resource that people actually can have, they can access, which is so beautiful, I think.
This month, I have sent out some information to schools saying, look, I'm available to do parent evening workshops. So that would be the school brings me in, and we have a conversation like this with the group of parents, usually fifth or sixth class in primary school. That's where my great love is, because it's that sweet spot. The kids are about to go into secondary school where there's so much more opportunities and joy, but also opportunities for pain and sadness, you know. So it's great to be able to talk as a parent community about what happens next.
Super important.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank
you for wandering up this beautiful mountain with us. Beautiful day.
Best idea ever.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cool. Thanks again.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe.
Please.
Comment below if you have any questions about this or anything that was said, or if you have feelings about anything that was said today. We'd love to hear from you.
And don't forget, there'll be a goodie bag giveaway at the end of each one from hopefully the next podcast onwards, and we'll start to kind of roll out. And as you guys do more commenting and more like,